It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Oh, do we have a good panel this week. Louise Mitsakis is here, now a freelance journalist, formerly with Wired. Owen Thomas is also here, senior editor of Protocol. And you may remember Evan Brown from This Week in Law. It's his first time on Twit. Be nice. Lots to talk about. In fact, I'm going to query Evan about the Facebook Meta trademark filing. Boy, they sure are staking out a lot of areas that Meta is going to be involved in. And then why is the future mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, saying he wants to create a cryptocurrency for the city? And we'll talk about the great resignation and how it all started with tech. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 848, recorded Sunday, November 7th, 2021. Rippling Chaos. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Molecule. Molecule is reimagining the future of clean air, starting with the air purifier. For a limited time, save up to $120 on Molecule air purifiers by visiting molecule.com and using the promo code TWIT at checkout. Enjoy free shipping and a 30-day home trial on your order. And by ESET. Nobody wants their organization to be patient zero in a cyber attack. Right now, ESET Protect Complete is 20% off. And you can try it before you buy. Get your free ESET business trial and an interactive demo at business.eset.com/twit. And by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like using the bathroom and not closing the door. Close the door! Secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/twit and get an extra 3 months free on a one-year package. And by Stripe. Whether you're an online or in-person retailer, software platform, marketplace, or subscriptions business like ours, visit Stripe.com to learn more about how Stripe can support your business today. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show. Yes, I'm back. Thank Ian Thompson. Thank you so much, Ian, for filling in for me with Father Robert. Great show at Brianna Wu. But I am back in the saddle again. We have a great show planned for you this week. All the week's tech news with Owen Thomas, senior editor at Protocol. Good to see you, Owen, in the office.
Good to be here.
Wait a minute. You got to show us your matching mask. Come on. He's got his shirt and mask. By the way, beautiful shirt. Kind of a Hawaiian style pattern. And the mask matches. So you bought the shirt and mask at the same time. Is that a new thing?
Apparently, there were a bunch of shirts, actually, that had that, wow, that kind of bonus.
Wow.
This is at Macy's, or Massey, as I like to call it.
Oh, I was going to fall into the gap, but okay, good enough. Also joining us, it's great to see you, Louise Mitsakis. Now freelancing. Great to have you on the show. How's it going?
Glad to be here. It's going well, Leo.
You're enjoying
it?
Writing for a lot of publications, Business Insider for one, and that's wonderful. Still covering China as well as the tech industry.
You got it. And those two things combined.
I think you're in hot demand right now because of the supply chain crisis and what's going on in China and everything else. This is a good time to be an expert.
It's a really good time to cover China in terms of, like, there's a lot happening, but it's also a terrible time in terms of you can't get into the country. So it's sort of a weird paradox in that sense. But yeah, totally.
So did you, in your coverage, did you travel to China a lot? Was that part of the deal?
So I was, like, sort of in the process of applying for a visa right when this all happened. So it's been 2 years. So it's been a few years of covering China pretty regularly while this has been going on. But I got to go once before this all happened. So I would like to spend a lot more time there, but it's sort of really debatable.
I probably told you this, and it's certainly on my Tinder profile. I was a Chinese. No, it's not. I was a Chinese major in college.
Really? Yeah. Do you speak pretty well still?
No, I forgot it. But I did intensive study for 2 years, and I wanted to go, but this was a long time ago. Nixon had just started to open it, And
could you even fly there at that point? Was it like, I was probably like, you had to fly through Hong Kong, right?
Yeah, no, and you had to go as a governmental program and you would stay in a commune. It was very, it wasn't that interesting. I've been there since and I just love it. I really love the
country. Such good food, right?
Oh, the food. But I love the culture. And one of the reasons I was a Chinese major, I wasn't thinking about a career or anything. I just loved it. I loved the language and I loved the culture.
It's really hard. So I applaud you for doing it. It's not easy at all.
The spoken language isn't as hard as the written language. The written language is murder. Murder.
It's even hard to write. Like you sort of go back to being three years old with like terrible handwriting. Yeah.
But the spoken language is interesting because it's such an old language. All the hard edges have been worn off. There's no tenses. There's no genders. It's a kind of a very direct language, so it's easy to speak poorly. Let's put it that way, except for the tones.
Anyway, it's like a lot like English, right?
In that sense,
tenses or anything.
It's not like Russian or Latin where there's all these declensions and it's a complicated language. Anyway, it's great to see you, Louise. And I have to say, the first time on this show, but a long time member of the Twit family, Evan Brown is here. You remember him as former co-host on Twill This Week in Law. He is an intellectual property and technology attorney, and you also teach law in Chicago, right?
That's right. I teach a class on negotiations. I'm an adjunct, sort of a wannabe academic, I guess. But Leo, it's wonderful to see you. It's great to be back on this platform. You know, we were talking before the show. It has been a great ambition of mine to be here on the big show for 15 years or so. So the big wonderful show. To be here. What a delight.
You're on the big show now, Evan. Ah,
this is great.
And I'm going to call on your legal services immediately because as last week, I missed the big story of the year, which is Facebook renaming itself to Meta, which I've been informed, by the way, is death in Hebrew. So maybe not the best choice. There is also a small, I think it's a Chicago company, that's suing them now because they say, well, we're called Meta. But I did, and thanks to John, who downloaded the 32-page trademark application for Meta. And if you just look at the red part here. This is, so correct me if I'm wrong, Evan, but when you apply for a trademark, you say in what category, right? So I have a trademark, I think, for Twit in like news and television and radio and internet streaming, things like that.
Which
makes sense, right? I don't have a trademark for popsicles named Twit. Somebody could come along and have Twit popsicles. That wouldn't be trademark infringement. We're in different categories. Facebook apparently does not want anybody to use the name Meta for anything. This is the description of their class. Well, it just goes on and on and on. This is the part in red. It's like periodicals, electronic publications, currency, virtual currency, downloadable software for creating, selling and managing blockchain-based tokens. It's for authenticating user access to computers. Is this normal that you would claim this much territory with a trademark?
Not real. This is pretty extensive here. I mean, a couple things going on. I mean, when you file a trademark application, first you designate whether you've actually put it into use yet or whether there is an intent to use. And so Facebook or Meta has filed an intent to use application here, putting it in a number of classes. One of them is class 9, which is downloadable software that actually goes into the user's environment. There's also classes within this application, I think class 41, class 42, more of the hosted services kind of things. But Leo, as you're very aptly pointing out, there is just, I mean, thousands of descriptions.
It's very long.
It's exhaustive. It's nauseating.
Personal coaching services in the fields of sports, exercise, health, and fitness. I mean, come on. You can't have it all. So what happens now? Does the USPTO look at this and go, slow down, big boy?
It'll sit on the desk, so to speak, of a bureaucrat in Alexandria, Virginia for 3 or 4 months, probably. Then what the trademark examiner will do is look at it First, they'll do a search to see what other pending applications or registered marks are already out there. And this is a separate issue, to see what might be likely to conflict, or what this might likely conflict with is already on the register. So it could be that there will be some issues. The examiner may issue an office action saying there is a likelihood of confusion, so we're going to deny registration of this mark on that basis, too similar to something that's already on there. Now, one of the things that's going to keep the examiner very busy is looking through all of these descriptions to see if they are accurate. There are certain ways you actually have to, your certain nomenclature, certain linguistic structures you have to use to describe the goods and services in the application. So there may be problems right away, and the examiner might come back, perhaps in connection with a refusal on the basis of likelihood of confusion, and say, "Well, this is too vague. This is, this needs some kind of clarification." So, getting to the point of what's going on here, why Meta has done this is in the trademark prosecution process. You know, the part of getting the application through to registration. You can always narrow your description of goods and services. You can always strike, but you can't add to it.
So it's good to start big.
It's incumbent upon them to be as broad as possible, and then, you know, you can take away as the market, or, you know, as the intention becomes more clear. But in any event, this is I don't recall seeing anything like this, at least among serious actors. It's You'll long. See people who don't know exactly what they're doing, but ostensibly.
And I just did a search on TESS, the trademark database for Meta, and there are 1,696 records with Meta, including the Meta Mafia, arranging and conducting esports competitions. I'm sure that esports is in the claim from Meta, so trademark.
Yeah.
So is it typical for a company just to say? I remember with the iPhone, Apple had a number of other companies that used that, and of course, in the end, what happens? A company sue, then Apple writes them a check, and they go away, change their names or whatever. Is it typical for a company just to say, "Screw it, we're going to do this"? And let's see what happens.
I don't know that that's always the smartest thing. It depends on what kind of power you're bringing to the situation, well, what Facebook's, kind of resources you have.
I'm sure Facebook's one of those companies that has probably a building just for the lawyers, I would expect, right?
Yeah, and an army of outside counsel, really skilled outside lawyers as well.
So,
yeah.
So it's a little hostile, but I could see how Facebook probably is stomping on some other people's trademarks.
I think so. I mean, the typical approach is to carefully consider – this is under the category of trademark clearance. A company is going to launch a new brand, a new product under a new mark. You look and see what else is out there, and you make decisions whether to go forward based on how likely you are to conflict. But clearly here, this is a special case, a special circumstance where we know that there are enough resources behind the momentum that – Meta will have, still hard to get used to calling them that, you know, to figure out how to get this done and clear the path one way or the other.
There's a company in Arizona called Meta PC. There's a Chicago-based company, Meta Company. In fact, Meta Company wrote a long open letter, and he said, in October, we had a phone call with Facebook's attorneys. October 20th, we declined their low offer. So 8 days later, Facebook filed for the trademark. Owen, are you aware? I imagine Facebook went to a branding company to come up with this name, right?
This was a very tight process from everything I've read and heard. You know, it was really, as with many things at the company formerly known as Facebook, it was a Mark Zuckerberg production. He wanted to do this. So it happened, and it happened very quickly. I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if there were some, you know, blowback as a result of the haste. But, you know, this is the guy who came up with the slogan, "Move fast and break things."
Right.
The thing that really strikes me is that, Zuckerberg wants to use Meta to actually brand things. So, for example, Oculus, the brand, is going away as a VR brand, and it's going to be replaced by Meta. And that's very different from what Google did with Alphabet, where Alphabet is basically something that comes up, you know, annoyingly when you're writing about the stock or quarterly earnings, and then you never think about Alphabet, except in that corporate context. Meta is different. It's not just the company name. It's going to be product names, too.
So it's not going to be Oculus by Meta. It's not going to be Facebook by Meta. or is it?
It is going to be, there are, if you fire up your Instagram app right now, you'll see it says Instagram by Meta, where it used to say Instagram by FB.
Right.
And so they've already made that switch. And sometimes it's going to be a product by Meta, and sometimes they're actually going to use, from what I understand from the company's announcement, they're actually going to use the Meta name. Portal, I believe, is a product that they may rebrand from Facebook Portal to Facebook Meta Portal Portal by Meta. Yeah.
So when Google adopted Alphabet, Google didn't go away. Alphabet became the shell company for a number of companies, including Google. Is that how Facebook is doing this? I'm unclear. Evan, do you have a better idea of what the corporate structure is?
I don't have the insight into it that Owen is describing that he has, but he's pointing to a really important distinction here between what is a trade name or a business name, which really doesn't have much of a public interface connected to the provision of goods or services. On the other side is trademark use, which is what the consuming public sees, and that thing, that symbol, that word, that logo that they associate with the source of particular goods and services. So, Owen, based on what you're saying, it sounds like the intention is to use it more in a trademark sense, attaching it to goods and services rather than just a corporate name. But Leo, to answer the real question you asked, I don't know about the actual structure.
It says Instagram from Meta instead of Instagram from Facebook.
Mm-hmm. And that would make sense.
I'm not
the
a
name
Facebook
company.
I'm not a Facebook user. When I go to Facebook, Louisa, go on Facebook. Does it say Meta.com or no? It still says Facebook, right? It's so weird.
Yeah, it's still Facebook. I mean, I think. My question is sort of like, how much is this about Facebook's name, right? How much is this about like damage control versus like, you know, sort of sorting out a corporate entity?
But like how stupid saying, do they think Congress, the courts, and the Department of Justice are? It's like, yeah, we get it. You're the same company. We're still going after you. It's the public, I guess, they're trying to confuse, but it doesn't, I don't think we're stupid either. Everybody knows what Meta is. Still Facebook.
I mean, right. And just like in colloquial context, like no one says like Alphabet is being sued. You know, it's still like Google and pretty much, you know, most of the circumstances. So like, I mean, Evan, you would know better, but like, is there like some legal benefit to having some sort of differentiation? So like the name of the company is not the same name as like one of your signature products, right? Like, is there some reason you would want to do that? Aside from like a reputational one.
Yeah, I can't think of a reason why you would why the name would matter too much. I mean, clearly you want to set up different entities so that you're managing liability so that the assets of one entity aren't on the hook for what one of its affiliates may be doing here. I just get the sense that this sitting all of the cynicism aside, not that any of us would be cynical, right? Mm. But sitting aside a little bit of this, what's Mark Zuckerberg doing? If we take it at face value, isn't this sort of be a harbinger or an entry into the greater importance of the metaverse?
Yeah, I mean, clearly,
so isn't
Mark,
that in and of itself?
I mean, and he had that goofy pictures of him posing with himself in the metaverse and all that. I guess, you know, usually the way a company repositions itself is they come out with a product to reflect that new positioning. This is very Silicon Valley. You print the T-shirt and then you invent the product. Mm-hmm. I guess you could say Oculus is kind of a metaverse, and they have a weird social network inside of Oculus that is unsettling, to say the least. I don't know. That's technically it's called the Meta Platforms Incorporated.
Yeah.
So that's implies that Meta is a umbrella organization over a number of platforms, including Instagram, WhatsApp, the blue Facebook, and Oculus, I guess. And then it's all Meta. I don't know.
One thing that fascinated me, Leo, is the idea that they're going to have a Meta account system. So in other words, you're going to have a Meta.com account. This is something that Oculus users really hated.
I did. I stopped using the Oculus because of it. I didn't get
right, because Oculus forced users to use Facebook as the login.
Yeah.
So they're going to sub that in with Meta as the login, but it's really unclear how that is actually going to work in practice. But I think the idea is that you do not have to sign up for Facebook, the social network, to get an account on these
on these services that are on. That makes sense. Okay. And I do
Go ahead.
Wasn't there a time when Google required you to have a Google Plus account to use YouTube? And I remember that was no fun.
Not just a time. You still do have to have a Google account. In fact,
Google Plus, I remember.
Yeah, right. But still, Google's Google. We've now seen the unredacted attorneys general claims against Google. We saw those a couple of weeks ago. And it was very clear that this whole thing to get everybody to log into Google services once, whether it's through Chrome or through a Google service, and then keep logged in, was just a much better way of gathering information about everything you do online. So there's, I mean, clearly the Facebook has the same interest, and having a Meta login just would make it easier to follow you everywhere you go in the world of Meta.
There's one final trademark point that we ought to at least touch on. It's probably pretty minor in the big thing before we move on from this. There's this idea that a trademark, you can't have trademark rights in a word that's merely descriptive of the goods or services. And it can't, it is descriptive if it describes some characteristic of the product. And so there is at least some nod to be made to the fact that the word Meta is merely descriptive of those services in as much as they pertain to the metaverse.
Right.
Now, it can acquire distinctiveness over time, but in order to be comprehensive on our trademark.
Yeah, and certainly if you look at the application, it does include virtual reality game computer hardware, augmented reality game computer hardware, mixed reality game computer hardware, virtual reality computer hardware. There's all of that that's in here, but also a lot of crypto. And, remember that Facebook attempted to create this Libra coin. I don't know what the status is of Libra. Facebook was kind of embarrassed out of it. But I could see there's clearly in this application a desire to create a Meta coinage, a Meta cryptocurrency, and Meta dollars. Of course, why not?
Leah, that's actually a fascinating side note to all of this. Facebook very quietly, as part of the Meta reorg, took its financial arm, Facebook Financial, and rebranded it Novi, which was the name of its crypto wallet. So Novi is now Facebook Pay, anything you do with Facebook and money.
Is it just that snarky paranoia that you talked about, Evan, or is it really something we should be worried about? Facebook makes me nervous in their ambition. Is that just paranoia, Louise, or is there something really to worry about?
I mean, I think that there's something to worry about, right? But I do worry about sort of like Facebook ubiquity, I guess, because like they are such a name and they have such a bad reputation now that I worry sometimes like that there are more nefarious things that are happening with companies that are not household names, I guess. But I think that there's, good reason to be worried. And I think, if anything, the last, I guess, more than a month now, right, like the Facebook papers have sort of shown us that, like, they knew that there was cause for concern too, right? Like, it's not just sort of the outside voices. So I think that, you should be nervous and you should be skeptical. But I think also be conscious of making sure that, there's still some air left in the room for other things to be worried about?
Oh, there's plenty to worry about. I'm worried about everything. But I have to say that if the intention of renaming themselves was to calm people down, it did the exact opposite to me, especially when you look at this trademark. It looks as if Facebook has grand ambitions well beyond a social network, and that they're kind of establishing that whole idea in the renaming. Or maybe I'm just being a little bit paranoid.
I mean, I think it's legitimate to think that, but I wouldn't let the trademark application in and of itself, pour too much fuel on that fire.
That's why you're on, is to calm me down. Talk me off the ledge.
Whatever I can do.
I appreciate it. Here's the picture of Mark with his trying on Zuck outfits. I don't know why Mark doesn't understand how creepy this appears to people in the real world. That's what worries me the most, is that Mark seems to be in a different universe. He doesn't seem to have a sense of how off-putting and scary this is for people, and how people are really worried about Facebook's invasion of their privacy. He just says, "Well, it's good if you connect. It's good.
I think these companies have really strange internal cultures. And sometimes if you've been like sort of like lost in the sauce for too long, like I think that the presentation probably would have gone over a lot better internally is what I'm saying. Because I think that there's sort of a weird, especially among people who are like evangelists, like internally and have been there for a long time. I think that like some of these things that we might see as like really weird or chooky are not so. And then like all of a sudden Zuckerberg, even though he does this all the time, but I think then gets in front of the whole world and is like, right? You guys, you're into this, right? And we're all like, no.
I think you're exactly right. I think Google goes through the same thing because it's such an insular environment when you're working at these companies that you forget how normal people, in fact, in general, you could say that about Silicon Valley, that you forget how normal people think about this stuff. As engineers and technologists and enthusiasts, even I have this problem. I go, oh, this is great, a folding phone. And normal people go, what? No. So I think that is a big problem in these companies. And I think it's a problem in Silicon Valley in general, which is one of the reasons more diversity in Silicon Valley is probably a good thing. All right.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the case in any like big institution, right? Like if you sort of become too much part of that institution, but I think especially like Silicon Valley, to your point, because it's been sort of a very like homogenous place and you get on that bus, right? Like I always think about that in San Francisco, like how weird it is that you like get on the bus and you like leave town every day and go to like the Facebook village, yeah. Right? Like yeah. The hedge fund guys in New York, like also out of touch, right? But like, we're all yeah. On the same subway.
Right.
We're all going to Manhattan, right? Like it's all like, we're all sort of there. They have to at least like, you know, be amongst the people, but it's not the case in Silicon Valley. You get on that bus. I mean, not really anymore. Right. But you know.
Well, they run from their tri-level condo into the leather clad environs of the Google bus with high speed Wi-Fi. They bus down to Mountain View. They go into the Googleplex where all the bicycles are rainbow colored. And there's candy in the cafeteria for the taking. And then they don't make a trip down to Rainbow Groceries. They don't. They don't have to. They get fed.
if anything, remote work makes us worse, right? Because, you know, you are just completely in your bubble. You're in Slack, or Facebook even has its own version of Slack, so they don't, you know, don't use the same tools as everyone else. Like, if you're in Google, you know, if you work for Google, you're kind of in this Google bubble. You know, there's if you work from home, there's really no reason to kind of step outside.
So I'm glad you're in the office, Owen.
Exactly. I ventured out into the wilds of downtown San Francisco. I can report there's no zombie apocalypse at the moment.
What a relief. Actually, it's interesting. On this trip to Mexico, I was just on. I found out most of the people on it were geeks because it was Mike Elgin and his wife doing it. And so they knew Mike. They knew Twit. A lot of them were Twit fans. There's only four other couples, but one of them was a Facebook engineer and his wife works for the city government of San Francisco. So it was a twofer. It was great. They were very, very nice people. I won't out them, but they were very nice. And he pointed out, and I want to emphasize this. He says, however you feel about the company, there are really great people working inside. And I think that's always the case, whether it's Microsoft, Google, or Facebook. The individuals, especially the engineers, I love every time I meet them. They're great people, but something about the corporate layer is the disconnect, I guess, you know?
So, Leo, there's no one good at Apple or Amazon. Is that what you're saying?
Amazon and Apple, too. No, I know.
I'm just kidding.
As a tech journalist, I grapple with this. I don't deal with PR people. I try not to get to know people at the companies. It's very hard to be mean and cruel about Apple or Facebook or Amazon or anybody else if you know these people. For me anyway, maybe not for you, Owen, but for me, I like them and I don't want to say mean things and I don't want to hurt their feelings. So in a way, I try to distance myself from the individuals so that I can at least attempt to be objective about this. I don't know. Do any of, I mean, Louise and Owen, you cover the technology industry as your daily bread. How do you grapple with that?
I mean, it is sometimes awkward at parties, but yeah. I mostly don't go to parties.
That's right. I don't go to parties. It's the same problem in covering the White House and covering Congress. It's beltway journalism. You need these sources. You know these sources. You like these sources. It makes it very hard to be critical because you got to see them then at a party. So I stay home.
I think.
Go ahead.
You just got can't, like, your friends and your sources can't be the same person. And I think you kind of have to, like, make that choice pretty early, right? And, like, definitely don't, you can't be friends with PR people, I don't think, really, like, actual friends, you know? But I think, like, in terms of sources, like, you kind of have to decide.
Right.
All right, this person's my source. Or, like, you know what? I actually like them too much. Like, we're going to be friends.
That's right. I like a lot. There's a lot of people in PR I like. A lot of people are in PR because they're likable. And I don't want to know them because I don't want to like them. All right, let's take a little break. When we come back, the new mayor of New York is taking his first three paychecks in Bitcoin. What do we make of that? We'll talk about it in just a bit. Our show today brought to you by the fresh air that I am breathing. We first started using Molecule a long time ago because we live in the country and there's lots of dust and pollen in the air. And then the fires 2 years ago hit Sonoma County, and we were so glad we put another Molecule in the studio. I have a Molecule in my office. We have a Molecule in the three Molecules in the house. Molecule is the future of clean air. It is not a filter system that you're kind of used to. It is an air, literally an air purifier. Not just an innovation on the existing HEPA filters, but a scientific breakthrough in air purification. And it's really important, not just because of COVID, but in any office. This office, we have sealed windows. Indoor air can be five times worse than outdoor air, according to the EPA. So having a Molecule in here is so important to me. Molecule's core technology, they call it PECO, P-E-C-O, photoelectrochemical oxidation, doesn't just trap pollutants, it actually destroys them. And even smaller pollutants that a filter could capture, viruses, bacteria, mold, even volatile organic compounds. And if you're curious, if you go to the Molecule webpage, you can read the research where they show that the Molecule reduces VOCs like formaldehyde, things that you can't see, you can't smell, you can't trap with a filter, but you can stop with PECO. Molecule air purifiers are designed to help protect homes, businesses, even medical spaces by destroying pollutants and providing clean air. In fact, Molecule's PECO technology meets the performance requirements and FDA guidance for use in help reducing the risk of exposure to COVID in healthcare settings. The Molecule Air Pro RX is a 510K Class 2 medical device cleared by the FDA for medical purposes to destroy bacteria and viruses in the air. A lot of dentists' offices and medical offices have them. There are a variety of molecules, though. You may not need the RX version, the Molecule Air Mini for smaller rooms like a bedroom up to 250 square feet. There's the Molecule Air. That's what we have in here for rooms up to 600 square feet. Actually, we have in here the new Molecule Air Pro as well, for 1,000 square feet. So really, the whole studio has clean air. There's even the Molecule Air Mini Plus, which helps protect small rooms with a particle sensor and auto protect mode, which adjusts the fan speed based on the sensor. I love it. Our Molecule is in the bedroom, and I have it set so it comes on. You can leave it on all the time. That's probably the best way to use it, but I don't want to have that light in the bedroom. So I have it comes on in the morning, and I can just tell it's just burning up all the stuff. It's trapped overnight. It's very cool. Right now, you could save up to $120 on Molecule air purifiers by visiting molecule.com. There's actually two filters. There's a filter at the bottom that gets like the larger particles, and then it draws the air up through. It's a cylinder. It's beautiful. Where there is a converter, a catalyst, that then traps these smaller molecules and destroys them with light. I forgot to mention it, but Mike Elgin carries a Molecule with him as they travel around. And you need it in Mexico, in Oaxaca, because there's so many wood fire kitchens. There's a lot of smoke. And it's really, we kind of wish we'd brought our Molecule myself. There's a lot of smoke from the wood fires. For a limited time, save up to $120 on Molecule air purifiers. Visit Molecule, M-O-L-E-K-U-L-E, molecule.com. And use the promo code TWIT. You also get free shipping and, of course, a 30-day at-home trial on your order, so there's no risk. And if you are at all interested, it's really worth going to the website and looking at the reports, the papers, the research, the white papers, the description of that technology works. I think any geek would be very interested in this. It really is cool. Offer code TWIT, T-W-I-T, Molecule, Com. We thank them for their support of This Week in Tech and for the clean air in the studio. And I could tell you, when the fires were happening, that was a blessing. Man, that was a stinky, stinking situation. So Eric Adams, who's the mayor-elect in New York City, is going to take his first three paychecks in Bitcoin. And he says, crypto should be taught in schools. What? What do you think, Louise?
I mean, one question I had, and I don't know, like, I'm not like a local city politics reporter, like I'm not the person to verify this, but like, does he have any crypto, and do we know? Because like, this to me is just like such like fodder.
Oh, for, like, is it like when Elon says Dogecoin is a great investment, you think?
I mean, I don't know if that's like literally his intention, but like, it just really reminds me of like, just like fluff, right? Like hype, like it doesn't mean anything really. So like, it's just designed to sort of like get headlines.
It
like,
reminds
I don't know.
Me a little bit of when for a while it was fashionable to say, yeah, every kid should learn to code.
It reminds me of that too.
Yeah. As if that's going to save the world. Oh yeah. If everybody knows how to code, well, step three, profit.
Right, exactly.
He said, he was on CNN on Sunday. He said, when I talk about blockchain and bitcoins, young people on the street, this does not sound like an accurate anecdote, young people on the street stopped and asked me, what is that, Mr. Mayor? He said, and they asked him, well, can you explain what it is? He said, well, I know it's a challenge even for experts. He says, Bitcoin means this is a quote, new way of paying for goods and services throughout the entire globe. And that's what we must do. Open our schools to teach the technology and teach this new way of thinking.
Oh, boy. I mean, where to start? First of all, Bitcoin is not actually practical for everyday transactions. I mean, if you look at the launch in El Salvador, where it was declared legal tender, it was very rocky. You know, they're using something called Lightning, which is a new technology kind of grafted on top of the Bitcoin blockchain to make transactions a little more practical. The problem with Bitcoin is, like, you know, actually exchanging, you know, sending Bitcoin to someone, exchanging Bitcoin for dollars is very costly.
Both not only in financially, but also environmentally.
Right. Yeah. It's computationally intense, which is kind of where both forms of cost come from. And also slow, like the Bitcoin blockchain is very slow compared to like Visa or MasterCard. So, you know, I think he's getting way ahead of himself saying, you know, like, you're going to be using this to buy and sell stuff.
He is putting his paycheck where his mouth is. He's going to take his first three paychecks in Bitcoin, which I'm sure is driving the city financial people crazy. Like, we don't know how to – what?
So I actually looked into this, Leo. And by the way, Eric Adams said he was going to take three paychecks in Bitcoin because he was trying to one-up the mayor of Miami.
Oh, Francis, it's all about Suarez, that. Yeah.
Who said he was going to take a paycheck in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So it turns out in Florida, there's a law that if you don't pay an employee in cash, if you use like some kind of coupon or scrip, and the value of that coupon drops in value in the next 30 days, that you have to make the employee whole. So there's a chance that, you know,
oh my God,
Francis Suarez might be able to double dip, like get paid in Bitcoin, and then if the price of Bitcoin drops, he might be able to, you know, get a sweetener from the city of Miami. I don't know that has ever been applied to cryptocurrency, but I did find that law on the books in Florida.
Very interesting.
And you know, the whole idea, like, how are you going to graft Bitcoin onto a payroll system? There is a company that does this called BitPay, and that though is mostly designed around the idea that you've got like contractors overseas and you want to pay them in Bitcoin.
Right.
Not something that's going to go through a regular American payroll system. And like, what are they going to do? Take some Satoshis out to pay for the Social Security and Medicare withholding? Like, and then what is the U.S. Treasury going to do?
I could just see the payroll people going, we don't, how do we don't, this doesn't.
How about, Mr. Mayor, how about we give you cash and you buy Bitcoin?
I think that's really probably because. And at what point, since Bitcoin is so volatile, when do you make the conversion? Like the last minute of the pay period? When? John, can I pay you in Bitcoin? Would that be okay? You want? Yo, he likes that idea.
It's only going to go up.
It's all. Yeah. Well, we'll see. it's only going to go up in the long run.
There was an employer who paid an employee in Bitcoin, and then when Bitcoin had an enormous run up, he tried to get the money back.
can't do that. Nope.
Like the difference in you know, what it was worth.
I overpaid you. Yeah. You're right about Suarez, about Miami, because he also says, just like Miami, apparently Miami has, Suarez has announced they're going to have their own cryptocurrency called Miami Coin. And Adams told Bloomberg Radio he wants to explore setting up a New York City cryptocurrency. So it's not just Bitcoin. He loves it all. It's all going to be good. I think it's good to teach kids STEM. I think that's a good thing. I don't know if they really need to know about Bitcoin. Maybe, I guess, blockchain, maybe.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I mean, what politician's going to pass up the opportunity for some spectacle here? It's good to see this friendly ribbing, you know, between Mayor-elect Adams and Mayor Suarez. You know, you can expect that. And there's probably some truths to be extracted from that. You know, that anecdote of him walking on the street, kids asking him about, I don't know.
What is that, Mr. Mayor? What is Bitcoin?
Right. I mean, clearly, you know, I think reasonable person could suggest that it's good to learn about blockchain technology. There's plenty of fundamentals there. And so
and you could learn about economics if you learn about cryptocurrency. I mean, that you're
I think you could
fiat
get, yes.
currency. You could use this in an economics curriculum.
But yeah, I don't very think, sophisticated understanding.
Yeah. Exactly. It's just politics, right? It's just politics. And I do think it has a lot to do with the mayor of Miami getting a lot of attention for cryptocurrency.
I think Miami and New York are both jostling for crypto startups. I think that's really.
That's the real thing, right? That's where the money really is. They lost out on Amazon's headquarters, too. So maybe we can get. I don't know, Coinbase headquarters too. I don't know.
But gosh,
you
want to
be the
Leo,
cool
you just,
crypto.
Yeah. You just touched on it, Leo, in passing. But my gosh, it must be so difficult for politicians to consider how to address the environmental issues of these.
Well, that's a big one.
Cost.
Yeah, that's a big one. And I know
that surrounds the whole discussion.
When we bring this up, I'll be fair. There have been a lot of people who've said, no one ever talks about how much the banking system costs environmentally, but there is an environmental cost to Visa, MasterCard, and the banking system because they all are based on computers. It all uses, resources. And we don't ever even make that calculation. So maybe it's unfair to Bitcoin to say how expensive it is environmentally. And also there is maybe not so much with Bitcoin, but certainly with other cryptocurrencies like Ethereum, a move towards more environmentally friendly technologies like proof of stake instead of proof of work. So I think people are aware of it. I don't know how fair it is to paint Bitcoin as the environmental evil when, you know, we're also doing all sorts of other things that might be equally evil and we just accept them because it's always been that way. You know, there is an interesting sidelight on the House infrastructure bill, which just passed. It does have a crypto tax provision and a reporting provision that says you have to report if you and the crypto folks were a little upset about this. If we've always said if the cash transaction, this has been for 40 years, is over $10,000, the law says that the recipient bank or whatever has to verify a bunch of personal information and notify the government. Apparently now they're going to have to do the same thing with crypto. The crypto industry did not like this, but they were not able to get rid of it. So the president is now, it's on his desk for signature. The reporting requirement, and this is from Coindesk.com, would see all brokers report transactions under the current tax code, I presume of a value of $10,000 or more. A violation of this, by the way, is a felony. And some have said, and maybe I'll defer to our attorney on the panel, that when applied to cryptocurrencies and other digital assets like NFTs, the law could be nearly impossible to comply with. So that's something scary for people who are dealing in crypto. I guess it's really going to depend on how the Treasury decides to enforce this and what enforcement they...
Yeah, like, is this a case of the crypto community sort of like trying to read the tea leaves in, like, you know, regulation that's just sort of unclear at this stage, right? Because I know that there's been a lot of sort of like understandable to some extent, but I know that there's been sort of a lot of hysteria in the crypto community about like some of these regulations that are like...
They don't want any targeted. They don't want any regulation. For a lot of crypto people,
right.
The whole point is this is a non-governmental, non-centralized thing. Stay out of it.
Well, and also specifically, like, it's one thing where, when, you know, literally the Treasury or, like, literally Congress is looking at crypto, right, versus they're trying to regulate, like, some aspect of the financial industry, and the crypto community is like, well, if this is applied to us, like, we're screwed, right? And it's not clear to me that they're necessarily even, like, the target of this, right?
Well, I think like it's also reasonable for governments to say, well, look, if the mayor of New York's going to get paid in crypto, we need to be able to take taxes. I mean, it's not unreasonable if we're starting to, you know, if crypto starts being used as a payment system. And I think a lot of crypto fanatics would like to say, no, this is like barter. This should be completely independent of any financial system and certainly not taxable. Well, bad news. I think, you know, it's already taxable and I think it's going to get worse. Their real concern was, what is a broker? And because brokers have this obligation to report, who is that? Does that everybody? All brokers have to report transactions over, I guess, $10,000. So anyway, that is the law, but how the Treasury enforces it is really going to be the question. Anything to add to that? I mean, this is not strictly in your ballpark, Evan, but you are at least you did pass the bar.
right. Yeah, I would, you know, the first thing I would do would be call a tax attorney or an accountant, you know, to get on these things. But, you know, just sort of underscore a couple of the things that you said, Leo. I mean, this seems to really be an attack at one of the fundamental, talking points about cryptocurrency in general. Its decentralized nature, its anonymity, the ability to do these transactions without easily being traced and you're figuring out who that is. But at the same time, I don't know that we should be surprised at all that the IRS or that there would be legislation that would at least appear, and I haven't read the bill, and I know that that's one of the things about it, that it's this gargantuan thing.
It's kind of big.
Knows precisely what's in it. Yeah.
But,
I mean, should we be surprised at a philosophical, you know, sort of abstract level that a progressive administration would pass would sign a bill that was passed by a Congress comprised how it is that's going to give more power to the taxing authorities like this. So I'm just really speaking in the abstract. On those.
It's a question mark.
But Leo, I think what it highlights is that we still don't know from the U.S. government what crypto is. Like, now we've got some tax rules here that suggest crypto should be taxed like securities because you're talking about taxing capital gains. But there are other parts of the government that think cryptocurrencies are currencies. And that, you know, is it a currency? Is it securities? Is it property? You know, throw NFTs in there. I think we still need a lot more regulatory clarity from the highest levels of government what crypto is. Because otherwise you're going to have piecemeal regulations that don't fit together.
As I remember, the new Treasury Secretary, one of the things that encouraged people about this is that he understood a little bit about more than others.
Oh, the SEC chair.
That's Gary the Gensler, SEC chair, yes. The Gensler. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Yeah. So maybe there is some intelligence coming to the government about this stuff. I mean, I don't understand it. I think most people... There are so many ramifications. There was a great piece in Protocol about meme coins. You know, my daughter's saying, I got rid of my Doge and I've got some Shiba Inu. And it's like, oh, dear. and all of it's highly volatile, right? Dogecoin is now second to Shiba Inu, which is another dog. Actually, wasn't Doge Shiba
the dog,
Inu?
Yeah.
So I'm very confused.
So Dogecoin was a joke about cryptocurrency.
Right. Like, which became a real cryptocurrency that people made money on.
Right, that like Robinhood and even like SoFi supported trading in. And then Shiba Inu coin came about basically because people thought, well, Dogecoin's a joke. Let's make a joke currency about this joke currency.
It's a joke on a joke.
And yeah, as with many things on the internet, it just took off.
It's meta. But, oh, wait a minute. I can't use that anymore. I'm sorry.
Exactly. You owe Mark Zuckerberg $1,000. Yeah.
There's even a squid coin based on the Squid Game.
Or was.
Oh, what happened to Squid Coin?
Well, apparently the developers did what's called a rug pull, which means they issue the currency, they collect the money, and they disappear. And that is what people are saying seems to have happened with Squid Coin, because like it's gone, and if you bought these tokens, you're just out the money. And of course, cryptocurrency transactions, as we know, are in most cases not reversible, not refundable. You really have no recourse if something like this happens. So it's a cautionary tale. And I think it's a hard thing, to know what to do when there's some hot new token that like all the kids are talking about online. Is should you go run out and facilitate, trading in that if you're a business, if you're a Coinbase or a Robinhood, or do you need to be a little more cautious?
Are we in for a few years of just craziness around all of this? I mean, we already have.
Already been a few years.
Yeah, yeah. but as soon as it starts becoming, there's the governments involved, and not just our government, governments all over the world, and the World Bank, and they're talking about stablecoin, and as you said, we've even got countries using Bitcoin now as their currency. It starts to worry me that it's going to be a little unstable for a while.
Yeah. You know, there's something kind of poetic.
Go ahead, Louise, first. Yeah.
I think it is, but I also think that it's pretty clear that governments are moving towards some form of digital money, right? And like every country is going to want to have some form of digital money. Like it doesn't have to be Ethereum, right? Or it doesn't have to be Bitcoin or something like that. But I think that we're sort of moving to like a completely digitized financial system, and that countries are going to like sort of get with the picture, I think, eventually. What will it mean for $60 million NFTs? I don't know. But I think that like I have faith that like sort of governments are going to get with it because they have to, and there are some benefits of this technology for them, right? So I think that I do think it'll be probably continue to be a little crazy for a few years. And it's funny to like watch the trends, right? Like a few years ago, it was all about initial coin offerings, right? And now it's sort of like gone to like digital assets, like NFTs.
Yeah, ICOs were replaced by NFTs. Yeah. And ICOs, weren't they kind of, people started to realize they're a little scammy.
I think it was also a regulatory thing, right? Yeah, like all of a sudden you couldn't really do. SEC.
Yeah.
Yeah, you couldn't really do an ICO in the U.S. anymore, and then you couldn't do them in a lot of, like, there's only a few countries, like at least prominent sort of countries where there are large blockchain communities where you can really do an ICO anymore.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a cat and mouse game.
My question is how big does the rug pull scenario get? Like, let's say El Salvador is talking about issuing its own cryptocurrency. So let's say you've got some small authoritarian government of a country, and they issue a national cryptocurrency, and then they do a rug pull, and like the president is like, president is in a private jet off somewhere, yes. And like the GDP of that country is gone, poof.
I mean, that's happened before, right? Like to some extent, right? I think it was a few years ago in Cyprus that all of a sudden everyone woke up one day and the government just gave everyone's bank account a little haircut, right? If you like had your money in the national bank, it was like, oh, we're going to just take off 10% of that real quick, right? So like, I think that's already sort of possible. There are a lot of reasons why you might not want to. But yeah, I do think a rug pull from a government is amazing and terrifying. And also I'm curious about like, sort of organized crime. I mean, there already is that, right? But like, instead of doing ransomware, are these people going to move into shit coins, right? Is that going to be more of a problem? Like,
yeah, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. I should have mentioned this. This goes back now to February of this year, but there was an article, I don't think it was widely read, in Medium by a guy named Evan Hatch. It was a tribute ostensibly to a guy named Len Sassaman, who died 10 years ago, committed suicide 10 years ago, was an original cypherpunk and very involved in a lot of the early research on crypto. His death was almost exactly 2 months after Satoshi Nakamoto's last communication. And in this article, again, came out in February, Evan comes a little bit short of saying he was Satoshi Nakamoto, but boy, he sure gives some very strong evidence that if anybody was, it was this guy. He certainly had the knowledge. He had worked on many of the early technologies that Bitcoin came out of. Initially, PGP. He worked at PGP, and then later on anonymous remailers, which is really the kind of the ancestor to cryptocurrencies. I don't know. I wouldn't say pitch an article to New York Newsweek magazine about this, but I suspect that actually we do know who Satoshi Nakamoto was, or one of the people who was very much involved in this. And he passed away 10 years ago, which would explain why the literally billions of dollars in Bitcoin held by that account has never been cashed in. It's a huge amount of money.
The person's dead, right? Like, no one is like he's that on.
Yeah,
Brady,
and I think,
right?
It was this guy. It was $64 billion. Actually, it's more than that based on the latest rise in value in Bitcoin. It's a huge amount of untouched Bitcoin. And I think it was, in fact, I'm going to put my money on it being this guy, Len Sassaman, who is now gone 10 years, but who was a cypherpunk, very involved in all of this stuff. It had the skills, the knowledge to do this, and was very much all about personal liberties, privacy. He was fighting against government surveillance. He was the kind of guy who would create a cryptocurrency, and he had the chops to do it, which is kind of very interesting. Anyway,
wouldn't he think it was crazy then to have government run, you know, centralized?
Absolutely. That was exactly what they were trying to get around, decentralize. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much that's paradoxical about all this. I mean, there's the idea of that sort of becoming the norm, and you know, Leo, a few minutes ago you asked, you know, is this craziness going to persist? And I mean, certainly I think it's
going to get worse.
Human nature.
It's going to get worse.
Yeah.
It's going to get
worse. With new opportunities and the growing complexity of things. And there's a little bit it's interesting going back to the squid coin situation. There was in one of the articles in the rundown was this guy in Shanghai who lost $28,000. I think it's just interesting how there's a certain correlation, I was saying it was poetic that it was the squid coin that happened with, relating to the subject matter of Squid Game, where people are really in desperate financial situations doing erratic things. So, there's as long as humans have a certain desire and avarice, it's going to be this way.
Speaking of desire and avarice, it's time for me to take a break. But we will come back. Great panel. Nice to have you back, Louise Matsakis, now freelancer. So should people just call you and have you write articles for them? I think that's a good idea.
Yes, please. Yes. I would appreciate that.
L Matsakis on Twitter, LMATSAKIS. Owen Thomas, senior editor over at Protocol, which is a great, relatively new publication. I'm just really impressed with Protocol. Doing really good work. Yeah. And of course, our friend Megan Maroney is over there as well. And speaking of friends, longtime co-host at Twill This Week in Law, Evan Brown, attorney at law in technology and intellectual property. Our show today brought to you by ESET. I for the longest time, I would come into work and Russell, our IT guy, be there, and I'd be like a scene out of Marathon Man. I say, "Are we safe? Are we safe, Russell?" I'm so worried about getting hacked, about phishing attacks. Lately, we've been getting a lot of emails from people saying, "Thank you for the $500. The invoice is here. We appreciate it." Hoping that we'll call and say, "What are you talking about?" and then pay it. They're constantly attacking, and this is why. When I ask Russell, are we safe? And he says, we're safe. I say, how? He says, we use ESET, the global leaders in cyber security. ESET, we hear from them all the time because they are leaders in security research. Three times a year, they put out their ESET threat report. This is actually, and you've heard Steve Gibson quote it and others, it's a 40-page report. You can get it right now if you go to welivesecurity.com, search for threat report, you'll find it. Fascinating stats and actionable insights on topics like info stealers, ransomware, stalkerware, more the kinds of phishing attacks I was just talking about. This is why we're really happy we use ESET. You know, our editors, they do all of our editing using Adobe Premiere on lovely Dell Precision workstations running Windows 8.1. We don't want to upgrade them to a later version of Windows because it's a nice, stable environment. But how do they stay safe? We put ESET on those machines. And the thing about ESET that I've always loved is it's lightweight. It doesn't use a lot of resources, whether it's CPU or memory. So you get protection, top-notch protection, without slowing down. And that's something the editors really appreciate. It's faster and more precise than typical endpoint protection. Because of something called ESET's Dynamic Threat Defense, or EDTD. What they do, this is so smart. When an email comes in with an attachment, they use cloud-based sandboxing technology to isolate and detect never-before-seen threats. So this is really important because the threats are constantly changing. You can't just scan for known threats. You've got to proactively find these threats and detect kind of malicious software. And that's what EDTD does. It looks at documents, at scripts, and installers, executables, of course, runs them in the cloud, not on your systems, not on your network. It puts them up in the cloud, runs them, and analyzes them in this safe sandboxed environment. So they get code analysis and deep inspection. They use machine learning in memory. They actually look at the memory analysis. They use AI. They're looking for behavior-based malware. They look at behaviors, and they can allow or block a file in minutes. So before those files even touch your servers, but they touch your computers, ESET has scanned them and approved them, or you never see it at all. And this is amazing speed with no demand on system resources. That's what something endpoint detection just can't do. No one wants their organization to be patient zero in a cyber attack. We never saw this one before, but hey, you got it. Congratulations. If you want, you don't want to be that guy. If you're looking for world-class ransomware protection, you're going to want ESET's Dynamic Threat Defense. And it comes, of course, with ESET Protect Complete. That's what we use. It includes endpoint security. You get full disk encryption, too, with a really good encryption technology. Advanced security for Microsoft 365. We use that. Lisa loves her Excel. So they have native protection, but there are gaps, and that's why ESET is so important. Right now, ESET Protect Complete is 20% off. You can try it before you buy it. Get your free ESET business trial and an interactive demo. Go to business.eset.com/twit. We use it. It works. I don't know how. I feel like we've skated by. Never had a problem with malware. I guess I can thank Russell and I can thank ESET. You can't have Russell, but you can have ESET Protect Complete. 20% off with our limited time offer. Go to business.eset.com/twit. Russell not available. He's mine, damn it. But I swear, the poor guy constantly go, are we safe? Are we safe? Are we safe? Yes, we are. Thanks. Thanks to ESET. We really appreciate it. Let us continue on. Oh, yeah. Pappy Cappy just read the article I was talking about Len Sassaman. And there is actually a tribute to him embedded in the Bitcoin blockchain permanently. Another reason to kind of, it's interesting. It's interesting. I don't know. I don't know. Nobody's making any claims. Let's talk about chip shortage because it's far from over. Now they're saying not next year, but the year after before this starts to ease up. Wall Street Journal saying 2023. Louise, is this a China problem? Is it a U.S. problem? What's going on?
It's a good question. So I think that there are a lot of issues here. One of them is also just like more demand than we expected, right? Like people bought a lot more cars. They bought a lot more computers. They bought a lot more other sorts of electronics during the pandemic than was sort of projected, right? And also what you see with chip development in general is that it's the cyclical process that takes a while, right? Like, so we develop new chips, we figure out how to manufacture them on a big scale, we put all those chips in electronics, then we put all this money back into R&D, and that process happens again, right? And over time, we've seen sort of the, you know, pace at which chips improve, you know, has sort of been like the axis is shaped like this, right? It's been like going, you know, and that might be slowing down. So there are a lot of things happening, and the chip market is really complicated. But yeah, there definitely is part of this, which is like supply chain problems because of factories in Asia. So yeah, I think that that's part of it, but it's a really complicated market. And I think supply chain is really complicated, and we're seeing slowdowns everywhere with all sorts of things. And I think it's really sort of exposing for people that the magic of how they get that Amazon package the next day is a really complicated chain of events, right? And that's true for chips, and that's true for basically everything else. It's always sort of unsettling though, right? When you realize like, oh, I can't get the new iPhone, because like that's something we've sort of expected to be the case for 10 years.
Apple in its quarterly results, I'm sure we reported this last week, said they lost $6 billion thanks to the chip shortage and manufacturing delays because of it.
But they also had a revenue or profit.
They made money.
They made the most money ever, right?
Like, yeah. Well, that's Apple.
Record profits.
That's Apple, right? Oh, yeah, we couldn't. Course, we lost $6 billion, but we still had record profits. Yeah.
Right. Like, I'm like, okay, this is dire, but like, is it also that like you can't keep the electronics on the shelves? Like, is that part of it, right? Like, are you selling a lot more?
Well, and Apple's always been the poster boy for how to do this, right? They went to TSMC and basically bought up all their production. And actually, this, I think, has been part of the problem I've heard as well. Companies like Ford, car companies, Apple, and others hoarding chips. Especially these legacy nodes, chips, not the you know, the A15 or the M1, but the little, you know, doohickeys that do things like acceleration and GPS. Those are traditional chips. Others are vying for those chips. So these companies are buying them in great numbers and hoarding them before they're even using them, which makes it worse for everybody else as well.
I know, I saw the list of like some of the things that were going to be delayed, and it's so interesting to see just like how everything has a computer chip now. Like, one of the lists was like smoking devices, you know, like your Juul, right? Like
your Juul. Oh no.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know about it, but like, you know, some of these smoking devices, it's just so, you know, it's become so ubiquitous that we don't realize like how many things that's going to affect. I think cars is really big. I think sort of for your average person, because of course your car has computer chips in it, right? But like, I don't think, you know,
yeah, but if I can't vape, now we're talking serious,
right,
serious problem. Right. No, Lisa ordered a car in the summer. She wanted to get one of the Mini Cooper, electric Mini Coopers, was told to be 10 weeks, then got an email saying, oh, it's going to be 18 weeks, and supposedly it's going to come next week. But it really, that's the shortage right there. Really interesting Medium post by Ryan Johnson. He says, I'm a 20-year truck driver. I'll tell you why America's shipping crisis will not end. And he points out that it's not boats lined up at the container ports in Los Angeles and Long Beach. It's that you don't have enough crane operators to offload the boats. You don't have enough trucks to take what's offloaded. He says there's a huge crisis in truck drivers. And this then ties into this, the big, what do they call it? The grand resignation that's happening in America, where after COVID, people are not going back to work. They're saying, I don't want that crappy job anymore. And this guy's describing, you know, if you're not a union driver, it's a nightmare. You could spend a day waiting for a container to be unloaded, and you don't get paid by the hour. You're getting paid by the delivery. And so you're making pennies an hour because of the short staffing and the slow offloading and so forth. So there is a complex chain of problems.
Yeah, and that issue that you're describing, like, it didn't used to be that way, right? Like, we turned a lot of truckers in this country into independent contractors, and it was like, here's how you can get rich. You can buy a truck and become an independent trucking contractor, and it caused a lot of problems, clearly, right? Like, it made the job a lot harder. It put people in debt, and now with these shipping delays, they're not getting paid, right? It's like, what's the incentive to do that job?
Right. He says, this is the new normal, all brought to you by the experts running our supply chain. but it also, these experts, it made sense when demand was consistent and supply was consistent. You could do just-in-time shipping, just-in-time manufacturing, but it all collapses if there's a hiccup at any point. COVID started it. But then in the light of COVID, there was greater demand. That caused bigger problems. So it's a whole bunch of things. It's a mess, and it's not going to go away, maybe not even till 2024, according to the Wall Street Journal. There are things, you can order things now you won't get until 2024, which is kind of mind-boggling.
Leo, do you have any good stories of like the funny things besides the Mini Cooper, which is sort of expected, that you have discovered you can't get or that have been out?
I don't have a funny story. I have a story that makes me want to cry. I ordered because we wanted to review the new Apple MacBook Pro with the M1 Max chip. And I ordered it immediately, like as soon as they announced it. I said, oh, yeah, we're getting that so we could review it. And then our head editor, Anthony, who's using an two-year-old Intel MacBook, he needs a new one. This would be a perfect replacement. It was supposed to come on Monday. And I don't know what happened. The FedEx guy just didn't even attempt to deliver it. They just returned it. They said, we don't know where this is. Even though we get FedEx deliveries every day here, for some reason. So I called Apple. They said, it's too late. It's been returned for a refund. We'll refund you in a bit. I don't know when. We'll see when we get the money back. So I said, can I order again? They said, yeah, you'll get it. You'll probably get it before the end of the year. Maybe right around Christmas time. It's like, so that's not a funny story. It's just a painful story.
That's very painful.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Anthony. It's more painful for him than it is for me.
I interviewed a CEO recently who told me that back in January 2020, after he was hearing about, it wasn't a pandemic yet, but COVID-19 was getting more and more serious, he bought thousands, tens of thousands of PCs for his employees, just to make sure that they'd have them to hand out. And sure enough, it became a pandemic. It was a good bet because everyone who tried to go remote, like with a snap of their fingers in mid-March, and discovered, we don't have enough laptops. We have desktop PCs for our computers, and people can't take them home, and we don't have enough office chairs. We don't have enough monitors. But I think this is stuff that started in the pandemic for kind of understandable reasons. And now it just kind of feels like rippling chaos.
That's a great description. Rippling chaos. It's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And it's just like not attributable to one cause. Like people say, the problem is that Long Beach and Los Angeles only lets you stack containers too high because they're eyesores. And like, if you just stack them higher, that'll fix everything. Well, no, that's not going to fix everything.
And people ignore that. It's actually partly because of increased demand. It's not, the pipeline is choked because there's so much demand as well.
Right. You used to be able to say like, okay, around June, that's when you need to start stocking up on beach balls, right? Like you could have sort of like these predictable cycles of like, okay, early February, like you need to like increase your like chocolate box stock, right? Like it was sort of these very like predictable cycles, and COVID totally messed that all up. And it's so mysterious. I went into like, it's called Aesop. It's like a fancy Australian like skincare, and like, you can get soap and stuff there. And I just wandered in there in Brooklyn yesterday, and they had these very polite, really like discreet little signs that were like, due to raw material shortage, like this item is missing.
Oh no.
And I was like, what is it? Like what it like, but like they had like, 80% of their stock.
Right.
So like, what is it in like that one cream that you can't get?
Maybe you don't want to know. Yeah. There's a big cobalt shortage. Yeah.
Right. Is there cobalt in the cream? I don't know.
You don't want to know. No, I think that's the problem is it that's what rippling chaos is. It's a lot of different things in a lot of different areas and a lot of different reasons. And it really, I think we've been living fat and happy. I don't want to bring you down, but I just want to point out that in every case, when they talk about a metaverse in science fiction, whether it's Snow Crash or Neuromancer or Ready Player One. It's as an escape to a horrible corporate dystopia that real life is so miserable that people want to put on the glasses and go play in the metaverse. So maybe Mark Zuckerberg has his finger on the pulse of the future.
You need chips to power that, though.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Welcome to dystopia. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and I'm so glad you used the word rippling, because that's how I was thinking about rippling. Rippling chaos is the term you use. I was thinking about the rippling effect. I mean, particularly with the chip shortage, it really expands out to affect so much more than just goods, but it really starts to affect innovation as well. I mean, look at what cold water this is for, you know, the development of IoT technologies, innovation, you know, and hardware there. And then, of course, the innovation in the software and the networking and everything else that goes around that. So rippling is a very accurate way of thinking about these effects, particularly when it's something as critical as a chip shortage here.
And there is a cryptocurrency named Ripple. So it all comes around.
Yeah, I was thinking of the Grateful Dead, but we're all good.
Let's see, what else? Daylight saving time to change your clocks.
Showed up an hour early, so this is great.
We can't change our clocks because they change
themselves.
Chips in them.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a clock that was built in Ukraine, and it set itself to standard time last week. Apparently, so as everybody knows, in the U.S., we just now set our clocks back this morning at 2 a.m. I think we're one of the last countries to do that. I don't know why we still do that. All the evidence, all the research shows it's both psychologically and physiologically harmful. It doesn't save energy. It's got no real purpose. It's just one of those things that's hard to change. I was talking about this with my wife this morning. She says, well, I don't think we should change to standard time. I think we should just make daylight saving time permanent, which seems to be a popular thing, but that would require, I don't know what that would require, because that's your time zone. You can, it's basically saying, well, we don't want to be in this time zone. We want to be in a different time zone. I don't know who's in charge of time zones, but can you just say, oh, we decided we want to be in the time zone one over? I don't think you can do that. Can you? California.
It would make our situation with like Canada and Mexico would get weird.
Very confusing.
Yeah, that's the like thing.
I think they try to make the time. They're not perfect, but they try to make them align with longitudes. There'd be this thing where the longitude, and then it would go over like that, and then it would go over like that. There are a few places in the world like that, but it doesn't seem.
I hear it's bad for you, like to live really close to a time. Like if you like basically should be 1 hour different, yeah. But you're like right on the border. Yeah. It makes sense, right? Because there's no like radiation.
Yeah,
like there's no. Yeah, one thing I was just thinking about is I don't know if this is like a thing, but I wonder, is it fun to be in a bar at like 2 a.m. on a Saturday night, right when this is happening, because is everyone like, one more hour at the bar?
It's not closing time yet, buddy.
Yeah, like, I mean, the bars can be open later in New York anyway, so I don't know if it like changes anything, but because there are a lot of cities where it's 2 a.m., right? So does that just happen and then everyone's like, haha, never mind.
In California, it was a ballot proposition. And it won. I don't know if anybody remembers this, but back, when was it, June? We had a vote, and we all said we want to stay on daylight. I think we all said we want to stay on daylight saving time. I don't remember now. And then the next step is the legislature has to approve it. And then, I don't know, the National Bureau of Standards and Time and the clock keymaster has to approve it. And it never happened. In Europe, in 2018, the EU ordered everybody to stop doing it. No more setting the clocks back. This happened in 2018. The European Parliament voted to end the practice after a poll, I'm reading from ABC News, of 4.8 million Europeans showed overwhelming support for scrapping daylight saving time. The time change will be abolished, said the then president, Jean-Claude Juncker. People do not want to keep changing their watches, but along comes COVID. It was supposed to happen this year. And because of, I don't know how COVID is, among other things, it's delayed the time. So it's not going to happen, I guess. I don't understand why we still do this. It was to save coal back during World War I. Have we not saved enough coal yet?
Arizona rebel already?
Arizona and Hawaii don't do it. Yeah, they don't do it. Only about 70 countries still observe daylight saving time, by the way. It's not a majority.
Maybe we're going to have to adjust time zones so that we can reserve energy for cryptocurrency.
That's it. The cryptos are, I think there's an argument to say when one time globally, right?
Well, China does this. China has
many times.
China spans five time zones, but they only allow Beijing time.
Right.
So, which
you
is
just
very
get used to the fact the sun sets at 3 p.m. I mean, you just get used to it. Cows don't care. They don't look at the clock and say, well, you shouldn't be milking me now. They look at the sun.
So the day would change. The date would change globally all the same time.
Do you still have to have the international dateline, right? I mean, there still has to be that. No?
Would you?
If you eliminate, if you just say it's all one time, it's UTC everywhere, then that's it. So what do we, because then UTC determines when the new day is.
Yeah, that's going to be tough if the date just changes when the sun is halfway down.
Okay,
in the
maybe it's a bad idea. It's tomorrow.
I do think, like, for business though, like it maybe would make sense in an email, right? Because I always get really confused. I do a lot of calls, obviously, to people in Asia,
crazy.
And I'm always like having, and sometimes I forget because, like, I'll be like, okay, like 8:30 Monday, but it's like, no, that's 8:30 p.m. Sunday.
So confusing.
Louise, yeah.
Right. Like, you have to remember, like, when that call is actually going to take place. So yeah, it's really confusing. So it would be helpful if we could all just be like, okay, well, it's this
one time,
UTC, right?
Yeah. It's all,
like,
the same.
We could, but you start have your that time as well.
We could all, I mean, I always say when we talk about when we record the shows, I always tell people the UTC time because there's a lot of time zones and you have to, I'm not going to give you every time zone. You figure it out.
Where is UTC optimal though? Like, where does UTC like line up with reality? Because it's got to line up with reality somewhere.
Greenwich,
right?
England.
Greenwich?
Yeah.
Oh, it's England. Okay.
It used to be Greenwich Mean Time. They didn't want to make it all about
Let's
England.
Not give the British this. I don't think they deserve this.
It's UTC, which, by the way, stands for nothing. The French is CUT. In no language on the earth is it UTC. It's coordinated universal time. And in no language on the earth is it UTC. But they just decided, because nobody is sufficiently confused, we're going to call it UTC, even though that acronym doesn't work in any language at all. So I don't know. The only good thing about this is, thanks to technology, I don't have to set as many clocks. Did you have to ebb and wander around the house and set the clocks?
Just the old school ones.
Yeah.
Where you really,
we have
really
a cuckoo
have
clock, and I don't want to wind it backwards, so I just stopped it for an hour. That was the hardest one. But it is nice because your phone, all the devices you use these days to tell the time, all of them know, right, and just fix themselves automatically. Even my car knows what time it is.
My body doesn't.
Yeah, it's
I
like
woke
the
up
oven
at 5 a.m.
Yeah, it's bad for your physiology and your psychology. There are more car crashes on the Monday after. I think it's worse going to daylight saving time because you're losing an hour. At least we're getting an hour. No, out of sync says UTC is the French way. It's not. The French way is, go look it up in Wikipedia. You can see my argument. Let's take a little break while we figure out what the hell time it is. Let's take a look back at the week that I wasn't here for. How was it, John? We made a little video, the best of.
Many people know that there's a way to access emergency services with their device. You don't know what that looks like, what that experience looks like until you do it.
I had to try tapping my button 5 times to see what happened, and apparently I had the same thing. No, don't call emergency number.
Oh, I thought you were playing some kind of game, though.
It did sound a little pinball-y.
I'm sorry.
Previously on Twit. Windows Weekly.
At Build, Microsoft announced this idea of Microsoft Mesh, the metaverse for the enterprise, which is very...
The metaprise, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. I like that.
I will not, Paul. No.
Hands-on photography.
I have a question sent to me over on the Twitterverse, and it's about NFTs. I'm going to do my very, very best to try to explain this pretty lucrative, yet expensive, yet technical, yet not too technical experience.
Security now.
Microsoft said the availability of Windows 11 has been increased, and we are leveraging machine learning model to offer the upgrade to an expanded set of eligible devices. So you've somehow taken an operating system, but now it's so advanced that it can no longer run on all Intel-based hardware, only some. But you don't know where, what, or which.
Twit.
Nothing about any of this.
You left off the makes sense. They cut off his makes sense. I wasn't there for Steve's epic rant against Microsoft, but I hear it was a humdinger. If you haven't watched Security Now yet, you might want to watch it. So what did I take to Mexico with me besides my outrageous Mexican shirt that says Oaxaca, my cowboy hat, boots, and bolo tie? I took ExpressVPN, our sponsor for this segment of This Week in Tech. Going online without ExpressVPN is like using the bathroom and not closing the door. Okay, that's not an image I want to have in my mind, but in a way, it is true because you are literally in public when you're going out on the internet. Your internet service provider sees every single website you visit. And we now know from research, which just recently came out, that all the major ISPs, the FTC didn't want to name names, but all the major ISPs are collecting much more than just the websites. And it's absolutely legal for them to sell that on to marketers, ad companies, anybody who, the highest bidder, who then use your data to target you. Close the door and be a little more private. That's why I use ExpressVPN. Now, I was using it for security as much as privacy. There's really three reasons ExpressVPN is a great choice. Security, for sure. All your data coming from your computer is encrypted all the way out to the ExpressVPN server. That means no man in the middle. Nobody can see what you're doing. Even when you're exposed in an open Wi-Fi network, you're safe. So that's great. It's an encrypted tunnel, a secure encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. Not only does that protect you against bad guys, it means your online activity is invisible to your carrier, your internet service provider, anybody who wants to snoop on you. They don't know what you're doing. And when you emerge on the internet, you emerge with an ExpressVPN IP address, an IP address shared by other ExpressVPN users. So you're just anonymous. It's also, I have to say, a great way to watch video. When I was in Mexico, Netflix wouldn't let me watch the movies I downloaded. They say they're not available in this country. Boop, one button, ExpressVPN. Yes, I can watch it. It's a great way to eliminate those kind of regional content protection. So privacy, security, content. It's also super fast, super secure, but super fast. And that's why I really like ExpressVPN. They invest in infrastructure so that they do have enough bandwidth. Sometimes people say, I'm not going to use a VPN. It slows me down. Not ExpressVPN. You can actually put it on your router, protect your whole household, and no one will notice. It's easy to put on any device. They've got it for everything, including smart TVs, iOS, Android, Windows, Mac, Linux. You fire up the app, you click one button, and you're protected. And I tell you, that kind of protection is worth its weight in gold, but it's not going to cost you that much, less than $7 a month when you use our special offer. And I think it's important to pay for a VPN because you want to incent them not to spy on you, not to, to provide enough bandwidth to constantly rotate the IP addresses, all of the things that a good VPN does. And of course, those regular audits to prove that they do live up to their privacy policy. They never log you. Their trusted server technology keeps them from being able to log you. Secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/twit, expressvpn.com/twit. You'll get an extra 3 months free when you sign up for a year. That's the best deal. Big discount. expressvpn.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support and for keeping us safe as we travel down to Mexico. That was a lot of fun. I want to, by the way, thank Mike Elgin, who's on this show frequently, and you all know him. He worked here for some time as our news director, his wife, Amira. We did the, and I want to give him a plug, their Gastro Nomad Adventures. Mike had been talking about doing this for a long time. They've lived all over the world, and they've had houses in many, many countries, and they decided to use their connections and their knowledge to take people on experiences. If you go to gastronomad.net, they do experiences all over the world. The Provence is coming up, Prosecco. They're going to do Morocco. We did the Oaxaca experience through the day, with the Day of the Dead. That was just incredible. Amira knows everybody. We saw that we ate the best food, went to the best restaurants, met the best chefs. We had a cooking class that was unbelievable, involved catching our own grasshoppers, because that's a big part of Oaxacan cuisine is roasted grasshoppers. They were actually quite tasty. They're going to do Mexico City. They're going to do Prosecco. I think Prosecco is the next one. If you want to know more, it was a lot of fun. And I paid my way. They didn't give me a freebie. I'm not plugging it because I got a freebie. I just because I think these guys, I love Mike and Amira. And I think if you are the kind of traveler like loves food, wine, and wants to get a real experience like a local does of a city, you got to do this. GastroNomad.net. Thank you, Mike.
What a great brand.
Isn't that good?
Gastro Nomad. Yeah. It captures both concepts. It's a portmanteau.
He's been nomadic. They've been nomadic for a long time. In fact, I really had to entreat them to come to work for us. They lived in Petaluma for 2 years while they worked for us. And when we finally had to let them go, he said, thank God, I got to get back on the road. They don't want to live anywhere. They lived over the last, say, 10, 15 years, they've lived probably a year in Oaxaca, a year in Morocco. They've lived in these places, so they really know them. But they don't want to. They're footloose and fancy free. It's kind of neat. I think they're back in the U.S. right now. Mike's helping his son, Kevin, with a Chatterbox. They're doing a big event. And then I think they go back out on the road. So, yeah, it's really cool. Had a lot of fun. Brought the Pixel 6 with me. Thank you, Jason. Jason Howell let me borrow his Google loaner. Google approved it. Because mine came the day after I left. So I have my Pixel 6 and I gave Jason back his. But I wanted to try photography with a Pixel 6 because they're really selling photography. And I have mixed feelings about this. Any of you tried the Pixel 6? Are you familiar with it? No, nobody?
I haven't myself.
I'll show you. So one of the things they're really promoting is night mode, right? These night photography. So because it was Day of the Dead, we went to a graveyard. This graveyard is lit only by candles, and you can see some distant lights. This is actually the raw version of this. And then this is the computationally enhanced. And I have to say, does a really good job, especially if nobody's moving, which in a graveyard is not so hard. But I did like the night vision, but I have to say, and Aunt, I think Aunt Pruitt has said this as well. Let me see if I can find a good example. It does a lot of processing. And in some cases, the images that you get off the Pixel 6 are kind of, I feel like, a little over-processed. They look like they're oil paintings instead of
Do you have to like pictures. Hold it too, like with the night mode? Because the thing that's so annoying about the newer iPhones is like sometimes like you accept that the lighting is not good, but you like are trying to get that picture, right? But you whip it out, and if you have it in night mode, the exposure needs to be longer, right? And then so you're just sort of like holding it there for a while, and sometimes then like it gets blurry or like it's just not a super user-friendly experience to some degree.
They do. No, you do want to hold it steady, and if people are moving in it, they're going to maybe be a little blurry. But what they're doing is they're taking multiple images. I don't know if in the Pixel 6, if it's still... This is a Pixel 6 Pro. If it's still 9 images, it was 9 images in early versions of the Pixel.
It's like an AI, right? That it's
and
like
then they do—they kind of do HDR, you know, where they take multiple exposures at different f-stops and merge them together. But then a lot of it is AI. Boy, I'm sorry. I have so many pictures. I'm trying to find the one that will illustrate this the best. I have a picture of Lisa out in the agave fields somewhere around here. and it smushes it a little bit. Now, you only notice that if you pixel peep, if you really you zoom in. So this is a good example. In this image, it looks pretty good. And it is an HDR image because I can tell you, not that it was dark, it was daylight, but the clouds and everything, you get great sky detail, even though that's much brighter than the shadows in front of me, but you can see detail in all of it. But if you zoom in, I don't know if I can actually do this. Let me see here. If I zoom in on Lisa, I don't know if I can get close enough. Instead of doing what I would expect, which is pixelate it like this, I'm not going to be able to. It gets painterly. It looks like an oil painting. I don't know if I can quite show you. Yeah, it's not doing it for me. If you do it on it, maybe this will show it a little bit. Yeah, it's a little bit. So look at her hand. It's a little bit smeary. Instead of pixelated, the AI is trying to guess pixels, and as a result, it's not perfect. So I think honestly. It is, you know, everything everybody says about it is right. It's an amazing camera, but it doesn't replace a good camera. It's great for like Instagram, Facebook posts where you're not going to look at the pixels, pixel peep. This is a good example because you can see this is the raw and you can see what the original photo had. And then what it did to her face, it makes it kind of like a painting. It's hard to describe. So Ant Prutz kind of said that with his hands-on photography. I just want to kind of reiterate that. He's right. There's a lot of computational photography. And it is maybe not quite as pleasing maybe as the iPhone 13. I was going to say, oh, this is the best camera ever. I was thinking that from, you know, what people have said about it. It's pretty amazing, but it's computational. And it's very much not as natural as you might expect. And I think in some ways the iPhone does a better job. They're all good, given, you know, given the fact that it's this little sensor, a portable device in your pocket. Let's not be unreasonable. Faulty DRM breaks dozens of games on Alder Lake. These new Intel CPUs look very good. The benchmarks are really impressive, especially because Intel's under assault from Apple right now with the M1 Pro and the M1 Max. Alder Lake, their next generation, which is out but probably won't start appearing in computers till early next year, is very impressive. However, however, it does break DRM, which, you know, DRM is a problem. And apparently about 50 games just won't run on Alder Lake machines, partly because of maybe their big little design, kind of like what Apple's doing. Intel is pushing out a fix, as is Microsoft. Intel has a list of 22 games that don't work either on 10 or 11, 29 more that don't work under 10 but will work if you go to 11. And Intel says a mid-November OS update should fix the issue for 11 of those games. For the rest, Intel has to work with the game developers and their copy protection. Damn that copy protection. So if you're having trouble, I guess the general advice is don't be the first to use a brand new chip. Apple,
if you can even get a brand new chip.
If you could get one, don't use it. I don't know how all these people know it doesn't work. I didn't even know you could get an Alder Lake system. I guess they can. Apple has kind of taken a shot at the right to repair movement. This is from our good friends at iFixit, former sponsor. They call it a screen repair trap, and they say it could change the repair industry forever. Apparently, in the iPhone 13, if you get third-party screen replacement, the iPhone disables its Face ID functionality completely. We have confirmed this, says iFixit, repeatedly in our lab testing with many different phones on iOS 15 and 15.1. Others, numerous repair professionals have said this. iFixit says, a dark day for fixers, both DIY and professional. One of the most common phone repairs that, and by the way, it's common because everybody drops these slippery little things, that could be done with hand tools now requires a microscope, and you're going to lose Face ID. comments, thoughts? Apple's been historically kind of fighting the right to repair movement. I think you should
it's
third-party repair.
Isn't this just a continuation of the way they've been all along,
right?
Know, making it difficult to get into things. And, you know, one kind of window into this is the way the DMCA, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, has, you know, the anti-circumvention provisions. And then every 3 years, there's this process to identify certain exemptions to that, things that you can circumvent and it won't be a violation of the anti-circumvention provisions. And I think if you look at the general trend, those exemptions have gotten more robust over the years since, I guess, 2001 was the first year where there were exemptions, because it's every 3 years for that. And there's that, which is, I think, encouraging, but it also just seems like the general principle of the right to repair is in line with the way our sentiments ought to be in terms of consumer protection. The more sophisticated these devices get, the easier it is to be locked out. And so I just hope we see a more general trend toward regulation that is actually liberating to the consumer and allows there to be more. And I think let's remain optimistic that that will happen.
Apple has always said, oh, no. We're in favor of people repairing their phones, but we're just all about security. iFixit says it's hard to understand as a security measure because the Face ID Illuminator is entirely separate from the screen. You can, if you are willing to go through some hoops, join Apple's independent repair network, which then gives you, it's very much like John Deere. It gives you the ability to do the repair and then reauthorize Face ID through Apple. You have to log in to repair log the repair to Apple's cloud servers. You have to sync the serial numbers of the phone and screen. Apple can approve or deny each individual repair. And then if they approve it, your Face ID will work. This is a lot like what John Deere does. You can get a third party repair job on your tractor, but unless you have the special John Deere software to authorize it, you can't use it. And I have to say, I don't think this is about security. I think Apple is pretty clearly, and this certainly is the point of view of iFixit, established that they just don't want you repairing your phones. They want to do it. They don't want third-party
repair people. I think it's just
people.
Yeah, and I just think it's really concerning, especially just with the ubiquity of smartphones now. Like, you know, I had my car break down in the middle of rural Virginia, right? And I was able to find, you know, really kind of scary, but it was a shock, right? They were able to look at the car and at least like establish what was wrong with it. And it was a scary experience, but I wasn't inhibited by my car manufacturer, right? And I think that that's so important. Like, there's so many parts of the country where it is a feat to get to an Apple store, right? It might even be a feat to get to one of these licensed repair technicians. And it's such a disservice to your customers to make it super difficult. It's bad for the environment, because a lot of people look at this and say, oh my God, it's just so expensive. I don't want to pay that price. I'm just going to get a new iPhone, right? Like, if it's going to cost me a third or even half of a new iPhone to get my Face ID and screen repaired, might as well just like get a new phone and like try and recycle the one that I have, right? And that is sort of the incentive that Apple is aligned to, right? And I think that that's part of the problem. They'll say like, that's not what we're trying to do, right? But that's clearly better for their bottom line, because one of these existential risks that Apple is facing is that, remember, like, you know, in 2013 or so, you know, your friend would get the new iPhone and you would sort of crowd around them and be like, wow, like they have the new iPhone. Like, I feel so out of date. And that's not really the case anymore, right? It's sort of slowed down the amount of technological improvement between, like, you know, the 12 and the 13 or whatever is a lot less. So I think that Apple's incentivized to, you know, make sure you get a new phone. And one way to do that is to ensure that it's harder to fix it.
Yeah, there's a there is, see, Apple seems to be very willing to do things that are clearly for their bottom line and then justify it with some highfalutin philosophical justification. Oh, this repair thing is not for us. It's not that we want to make money on repairs. We just want to keep our users secure. Greg Federighi gave a speech this week in Portugal at the Web Summit, in which he said sideloading, because remember, Congress, the EU,
just thinking about this,
and the DOJ, all are, you know, and the courts are all looking, you know, at Apple's app store and saying, you know, in fact, in some cases, I think South Korea, they're saying you have to allow other third party app stores on the iPhone. Federighi invokes this whole idea of security to protect their business interests. And Apple, I think that's a very bad road to go down. He says, talking about overwrought, sideloading is a cyber criminal's best friend, and requiring that on the iPhone would be a gold rush for the malware industry. That one provision in the DMA, he's talking about the Digital Markets Act in the EU, could force every iPhone user into a landscape of professional con artists trying constantly to fool them. Okay, tone it down a little bit, Craig. And I understand that to some degree that, you know, that's accurate. It is a little more risky to sideload. Google's allowed that forever. And they have all sorts of warnings saying, you know, it's risky, it's so forth. Trust your users a little bit more. But I think you've got to stop using this kind of rhetoric to justify what is clearly just, I want to make more money. We want to make more money. We don't want a third party store.
Well, that's part of the problem, right? Like, that's part of the problem is that, like, it's often somewhat true, right? Like, for a while, there was this argument that was like, oh, well, there's less scams. There's less, like, malware on the Apple Store because, like, we're investing in this, like, really rigorous approval process, which, like, you know, other companies like Google don't have, or like that was the argument for a long time. Or, you know, I can sort of see the like really dystopian case. Someone buys your cracked iPhone on eBay and then they restore Face ID and then they steal all of your information, right? Like I can see these scenarios they're talking about and there's some like kernel of truth there. And so it makes it really hard to argue with. And it's really insidious.
Yeah. Just like think of the children, child porn, terrible thing. So we're going to spy on you. I think Apple, it's a bad idea for Apple to do this rhetoric when it's clearly about business interests, but they're pulling in these things to kind of justify it. It really, it puts a bad taste in my mouth. Am I wrong, Owen? Is this not?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think the folks who are really going to get hurt are some of the few retail businesses that are, you know, that have been getting by or even thriving in the pandemic. Like you think about all these little repair shops, you know, you walk through Chinatown, for example, on the way to our office here, and you see all of these little stores, and they used to sell cameras. The camera market imploded because smartphones took over, but now they repair smartphone screens. And, you know, and that's good for Apple. That's good for Google and Samsung and everyone selling a smartphone that, like, if your screen gets cracked, it can get repaired. I went to an Apple store here in San Francisco, and they said, yeah, we can, you know, we'll charge you, I forget what it was. It was like, you know,
$200. $250, like right?
Yeah, and it'll take 2 days. Or, you know, by the way, the genius kind of whispered to me, you can go to one of those repair shops and they'll do it.
Bad genius. Bad.
Yeah. Like even Apple employees are recommending
Craig Federighi is going to come knocking on his door, buddy. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, the reality is like we need our phones. You know, we don't want to be without our phones for
2 days is ridiculous. You know. You can't live your life anymore if it's going to be a 2 day turnaround, right?
Right. And that's why this ecosystem of small shops that will do it in an hour exist.
Here I am in Oaxaca in the open air market where they're selling, you know, meat with and grasshoppers. And here's a guy, just a little booth. What's he doing? He's repairing an iPhone.
Right. It creates jobs. It makes the phone more valuable because you feel.
Well, you own the damn thing. You should be able to fix it. God darn it.
And I think Congress actually is starting to pay attention to this whole right to repair issue. But it is complicated. You've got, you know, the companies are, as Louise says, they're putting up arguments that have some heft.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Repair your iPhone, the terrorists win. I mean, of course, politicians know this better than anybody. That kernel of truth supports the whole edifice of lie.
Apple, you know, you've got tens of thousands of smart engineers.
You can solve this. You can fix it.
Figure out something that makes, you know, repairability and security not in conflict.
It just feels like greed to me. And here you are, one of the richest companies in the world, although apparently Microsoft is now worth more than Apple, which is a huge surprise. Why? Don't be so greedy.
It was really like, for me, what really like solidified it for me, how ridiculous this was watching it happen at a state level, because we saw this sort of begin before like Congress started paying attention. It was happening sort of state by state. And the Apple lobbyists would go in and they would literally like take some like state lawmakers and they would like show them. I think one of the stories that came out a few years ago, Leo, I'm sure you could find this really quickly on the internet. I think it was in Vice. They like said that you were going to like hurt your fingers on the glass. Like these arguments were just like really silly that like you, people are going to get hurt if we allow this, like physically hurt. And it's like, this is ridiculous. You know, like most people are not going to try and do it themselves. I think it's great, by the way. I think what iFix is doing is amazing. You should try and do it yourself if you can. But a lot of people, you know, to Evan's point, are going to go to these small businesses. You know, my boyfriend and I were in Shenzhen and there was a little stall exactly like that picture. And I think it took 10, 15 minutes.
It's easy.
Yeah, it's really not that bad. And it was great. I think it costs like, I don't know, like 20 USD or something. And then we were on our way.
I think there's also a case to be made that it's good for the environment. It's good for humans. It's good because make these phones more repairable. I just brought we've talked a lot about it, the Framework laptop, because I wanted to support this idea of making something that you could open, repair, replace, upgrade yourself. You could do that with a phone. It's Apple's decision to make these disposable devices and charge more than $1,000 and every few years at a greed. And I think you can make them more repairable and you should encourage that.
And the problem is that that's what the wealth is built on, right? And like now you see Apple like sort of making this very conscientious decision to sort of shift to services, right? To shift to like their new gaming product, to shift to like Apple News subscriptions, because I think that they realize that the consumer wants that. The consumer does not want to buy a $1,000 phone and then need to buy another one in 18 months. Right. I think we're seeing sort of a revolt to that.
It does feel like Apple's doing this though, because they would like you to buy a new phone instead of getting it fixed, right? And they claim, and I think it's probably true, they don't actually make money on repairs. They probably don't. But it sure does incent you to buy a new phone.
I think it's also like just sort of the Apple like ethos of that company is that it's always sort of been this attitude of like, we have a lot of control over the product, right? It's magical.
It's the best
consumer
experience.
You can't go in there.
We're making
it's magical
best.
In there. Don't open it up.
It's magical. So sideloading cyber criminals' best friend, because we should choose what apps you can get on your phone. No one else. It doesn't sit right. Doesn't taste good. And I think it's a bad look in the long run for Apple.
I remember there was kind of a consumer revolt a few years ago. I noticed, you know, some of my friends, colleagues had cracked screens on their phones.
And
Oh my gosh. Like, don't you want to get that fixed?
I can't really see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody does. Everybody under 30 has a cracked screen. My kids don't want me to repair it because they also are so bougie.
Okay. I love it.
It's such an interesting cultural response to this kind of like, you know, like top down, you know, capitalist attempt to control things.
We're not done yet. A couple of final stories to wrap it up before we go, though. I want to tell you about Stripe. I don't think I have to tell you about Stripe. It's the complete payments platform. You know, you use it. Everybody uses it. Leaders of adaptive, flexible businesses choose Stripe as their payments platform. Why? Because with Stripe, your business can easily optimize your payments infrastructure. You can simplify your expansion plans. You can create new revenue streams, all to help you grow and initiate change rather than having to react to it. And nowadays, this is the time, right, to really start rethinking your processes. Businesses like Shopify, Postmates, Twilio all look to Stripe to power their, and I want to emphasize this word, global payments at Club Twit. We chose Stripe for our payment platform because it allows us to accept 135 different currencies and payment methods. It's so flexible, seamless, by the way, in accepting payments and issuing refunds. We just couldn't be happier. It is a great payment system. Twilio loves it too. And this is a real reason to love it. They increased their authorization rates by an impressive 10%. With Stripe, they ran an A-B test with multiple global payment processors and chose Stripe. Postmates, Stripe helped them generate over $70 million in revenue, all by increasing authorization rates. That's really important. Stripe is easy to use. Once integrated, their single platform and world-class docs allow businesses to easily experiment, to scale and grow revenue. Stripe processes billions of dollars every year for every size business, from little ones like us, pre-seed startups, to Fortune 500 companies. Stripe releases hundreds of features and improvements every year to help you stay ahead of industry shifts. And don't worry, as you grow, Stripe grows with you. It's completely reliable, five nines of API uptime. They do more than 250 million plus API requests a day. So don't worry. Don't worry. As you grow, Stripe's there for you. They've also invested, and I'm always happy to say this, in our Earth. There's something called Stripe Climate you should look into. You can direct a percentage of your revenue to help scale emerging carbon removal technologies. It's very easy as a Stripe customer just to turn that on. Please do. It's good. It's a good thing to do. So whether you're an online or in-person retailer, a software platform, a marketplace, a subscription business like ours, visit Stripe.com to learn more about how Stripe can support your business today. Great company to work with. We've been very, very happy. Stripe.com. Learn more and get started today. What do you think of the Great Resignation? I know this isn't a tech subject, but
it kind of is, yeah.
I'm part of it, so I mean...
Did you resign? Did you say, I'm done, I don't want this crappy job, I'm out of here?
I mean, it wasn't that simple, but I think that I was like part of... I think it's a lot about just literal economics, right? Like having some of these jobs became riskier and the market
because of COVID
account for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was also just like I thought about more like how I wanted to be spending my time, like what... Like what was the most important
quality of life trumps.
Yeah.
And I think your generation was sold a bill of goods by my generation, by the boomers, that, well, you work 9 to 5, 6 days a week, you put in the time, we're going to take care of you. And then it turned out, no, we're not in fact going to take care of you at all. And this isn't a good life. It's not a good life. There's a subreddit that I've become addicted to called anti-work. Where people just post, you know, all of the nasty things their bosses made them do, and quitting, and all of this. Here's a perfect example: a tweet. Sick of people saying my generation is poor because we don't work hard. My grandpa worked as a janitor his whole life, was able to support a wife and five kids in a 2-story house. Now, if you work as a janitor, you can hardly afford to live by yourself in a 1-bedroom apartment. That's accurate. And I don't blame people saying I'm fed up. At the same time, you kind of have to work, don't you? You can't just go home and watch TV. So I don't.
Yeah. I mean, I think about just like how much has changed, though. I was like reflecting on this the other day, because when I was 18, I worked at Starbucks, and you couldn't even wear like leggings. Like you had to wear like formal, like black dress pants. And I took out my nose ring in the bathroom every day. Again, I was 18. But now you go in there.
You must have left it in the bathroom, because I don't see it.
Yeah, I know. I'm past that stage, Leo, thankfully, past my nose ring stage.
Jack Dorsey put his back in.
Oh, good. Yeah.
I saw that. I mean, I think I have no regrets. It was definitely a look, but now you go in there and like there's a lot more freedom. There's a lot more, I think it's also like changing cultures about like tattoos and piercings, but I noticed on like their little bulletin board, it was like, you know, if you refer someone, you get like several $100 or something, and you see sort of like a lot more of these companies are trying to accommodate workers. And I think it's great. I mean, I think that like there's a better appreciation of labor now, because, you know, the attitude was definitely you should be so grateful to be here. Right. And I think that now there's a lot, you know, this is a transaction between two people, and the worker also has power. I think is, you know, what this moment is showing us. And I'm all for it.
I wonder how much it has to do with the fact that, you know, the last 2 years, we'll just round up and say that has had so much to sort of give us subject matter to think existentially, you know, where it could be, you know, getting ill, losing a job, losing a source of income, having a loved one ill, things going on political. And so it's been the natural impulse of thoughtful people to reevaluate their purpose. And that's sort of driving a deeper desire, deeper, guided by a deeper understanding to do something meaningful. Seems like we've always given lip service to that, but the context of the last 18 months, 2 years has really been more of a catalyst to actually make it happen in principle, not just talk about it.
And, you know, I think to tie it to tech, I think that
yes, please,
the great resignation has been,
otherwise I'm in trouble.
I think a lot of this has been happening in tech. A lot of it has to do with, remote work and like the idea that like, you can now get a job not from like this set of companies in a specific geography, but like any company in the world is now bidding for your services. If you're a software engineer or a marketer or have in demand skills, it's also global. In China, it's called the Lie Flat movement.
Oh,
so which is what it sounds like. Like I am just going to lie down on the floor and like not work because in China, especially tech workers are exhausted. There's this 9-9-6 system, meaning you work from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week, which the government there, the Chinese government has been cracking down on it as a labor abuse. I think that it's worldwide. That's probably what's most fascinating. And that's probably, as Evan points out, it has a lot to do with the pandemic that we're all experiencing at the same time. That's kind of making us question why am I working? How much risk am I taking on by working? It's really changed those calculations.
Well, it's clear that the pandemic exposed some huge fault lines in the economy, in our country, and globally as well.
I think it's worth noting, though, that like the lying flat movement is also like even bigger than just the pandemic, right? I think it's like to your point, Leo, about like, no offense, what your generation maybe sold some of my generation. Because I think it's also about like just not wanting to participate in this race at all, right? Like realizing like the idea of like, okay, I'm going to leave my village. I'm going to move to
Beijing.
There's
got to be something better than that.
Yeah, and it's interesting to your point, Owen, about like the backlash of some of this from the government, some of the companies. I thought it was interesting that I think it was like within 24 hours, at least 48 hours of sort of this like big shakeup at ByteDance, the owner of TikTok, the CEO sort of like receding. And it seems like one of the very last, things that sort of came down before this big executive shakeup is that they actually ended working that way. So now the hours are much more sort of like normal working hours. So they ended the expectation that you would work 9 to 9, 6 days a week. And now I think, let me see what the hours are now, but it's like they shorten them to like, more normal work hours. And I do wonder if that's also part about like retention, right? And like being able to keep people in an environment where workers are like, hey, wait a minute, I have a little bit more bargaining power here than I used to.
Well, it's also the case that during COVID, you saw these billionaire moguls become even more rich. It was a big windfall for people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. And I have to say, there is the other tech angle is that this maybe all began with tech workers, particularly engineers, who realized they were so valuable to the company that they didn't have to put up with crap, that they could say, no, we're not going to do that. And the company would have to say, oh, because you guys are valuable. You're much more valuable because there's a scarcity of talent. It's not a friction-free market. It costs us a lot to get new people, to train them up, to give them stock options. I think that also is part of it. It started
it's 10 to 7. 10 to 7, 5 days a week.
That's crazy.
So that's
they,
like,
are they all in the
reasonable.
Same time zone?
Yeah.
Is it the same time zone?
Also, remote work, it turns out, no employer wants remote work, right? But every employee loves the idea. Not everybody. Some people like the social aspect of coming to work. But a lot of employees are going, hey, this work from home is great. Now, obviously, you can't do that if you're a barista at Starbucks. But for a lot of people, information workers, I could for sure know that Owen and Louise have worked at home a lot. I could work at home. I don't. I come into a studio. I don't know about you, Evan. Do you have to go practice law or can you just do it at home?
I've been working in home most of the time.
That's good.
We're starting to reopen, but I like to stay home as much as I can.
Nobody's in a hurry to get back to the office.
No.
I've had some flexibility for a while, but I still think I like look back at the fact that I would go to the World Trade Center like multiple times a week, and I still get like this. I get like that's spooky to me.
Yeah.
You know, like it still seems crazy that we did that.
Who did you work for in the World Trade Center?
That's where Condé Nast is, the owner of Wire Magazine.
The old World Trade Center? No, the new one.
The new one, yeah. Not.
What floor?
That's a good question. We moved around. I don't even remember what
the last
floor was.
That's a hella tall building. I'd be a little nervous, to be honest, to be anywhere in a World Trade Center.
Honestly, it was very, very scary when there were storms, because you would be in the eye of the storm, and you could feel like a little bit of like swaying sometimes. Yeah. During my interview, I was up against like a floor to ceiling window behind me, and I was like starting to feel sick. like I was already nervous about my job interview. I say, hey, I got the job, but like, you know, because I would look behind me and it was just like so
I'm
far
this
down.
High. Yeah.
Right. But
I guess I'm the poster child for the new hybrid work style, because I came into our office, you know, mostly so I could, record this podcast with you good people.
Thank you.
And have a quiet environment and not bug my husband.
Right.
So it was, and it was nice to have the option.
That's what
exactly.
I do. I don't want to, but it's much easier for me to do this in a studio. Also, there's a certain something about getting dressed up instead of, sliding
it
over
totally
in your
is.
Slippers and jammies to the microphone. It's just there's
you feel like
it.
A real person. Yeah. And I also think there are tensions or things that you assume about people. Like they give off like a different Zoom energy, and then you meet them in real life and you're like, oh, like I made so many like wrong assumptions about how we were communicating or whatever. Yeah. Like I do think like breathing the same air as people is important, but I don't think you need to do it every day. But I really do think that there is some value.
A little bit.
Yeah. Company retreats, like take all the rent and put it into like nice vacations for your whole team.
There you go.
Yeah.
What a great panel, Louise. It's so nice to see you again. Congratulations on emancipation, Louise Metzakis.
Thank you so much.
Freelance tech journalist. If you need her, tweet her, LMATSAKIS on the Twitters. Is that a good way to get jobs, get work? Just tweet her. Tweet at her. Saying, I got an assignment for you, Louise.
I think it is. People come into my DMs, but also my email and stuff is on my profile on Twitter. Yeah. So.
Alwyn Thomas is here. He is now at Protocol, where he's a senior editor. Great publication. It's interesting. When did Protocol's like a year or two old, right? It's pretty new.
We're going to be two in February.
It's weird to have started a business 2 years ago.
It was a really strange thing.
Especially a free media business.
So I joined during the pandemic, but we actually had an in-person event as part of like a program of in-person events. We were planning to have like a mixer in San Francisco. And my colleagues were telling me about how like they were handing out drinks and hand sanitizer. And then of course, like,
and then
go days
home.
Later,
get the hell out
days
of
later, the world shut down. But we're starting to hold in-person events again. And, we hosted a dinner in Las Vegas.
Nice.
And, it was part of a conference where everyone had to submit proof of vaccination. So we felt very safe doing it, but it was still kind of,
I have to say traveling internationally, which we hadn't done in 2 years, felt like a death defying feat. That's the best way to put it. Spending an entire day in a mask in an airplane is no fun. But in the long run, it felt fairly safe. We had to get tested before we came back into the U.S. That was my one where I'm holding my breath. Please let it be negative. Please let it be negative, because I didn't want to get quarantined in Mexico for another 2 or 3 weeks. And we all tested negative. We were all careful. And it felt good. Felt good to travel again. Dare I say it was even fun waiting in the airport just to be out there in the world. It was great. Protocol.com, and it's free.
That's right.
It's free, but you should subscribe for extra benefits. Also with us, it's great to have you, Evan. First time, and you've done a great job, Evan Brown, evan.law@internetcases, if you want to follow him on the Twitters.
Leo, it's been a wonderful way to spend an afternoon. Thanks for having me on. Great to hang out with, you know, the folks in the Twit Army. Still called that, right?
Those yes.
Wonderful.
The Army marches on. A couple of quick stories before we wrap this up. I know you're all anxious to get on with your evening. Always excited when there's a new episode of Succession. Google News has won in Spain. Spain, you remember, ruled that they had to pay mandatory payments to newspapers for search results. Google said, fine, see ya. Guess what? Oh, maybe we don't need to do that. And Google is now back, and Google News is back in Spain after they retract that monthly fee requirement. You know, it just doesn't pay to fight the big Goog. Tesla had to recall 12,000 vehicles over a software communication error, and yet Elon Musk is now the richest man in the world by a significant margin. Microsoft, this is embarrassing. Microsoft's little apps, their snipping tool, their touch keyboard, their emoji panel, stopped working on Halloween. Microsoft had forgotten to update the certificates. Whoops. Voice typing, the getting started and tips section of Windows 11. Here's a tip. Keep your certificates up to date. They have tested a patch for the problem with beta and release preview testers, and they've now released a fix as of November 5th. An out-of-band update, because, you know, when you need the snipping tool, you need the snipping tool. Anything else did I miss? There's lots of stories, but I wanted to make sure we did a quick sweep. iPhones, apparently, according to the Wall Street Journal, are going to start adding detection for car crashes, and they will auto-dial 911. What could possibly go wrong? I actually had somebody call me who went over a bump in his truck, and his watch started calling 911. They said, you've taken a terrible fall. I said, no, you haven't. They usually give you a minute or two to cancel that out. I think we can wrap this up. Anything, any stories you guys are covering you think are important? I think we covered all the big things. I don't want to keep you too much longer. Louise, thank you so much. Congratulations again on your emancipation from the giant Condé Nast. Onwards and upwards. We always think you're great. And you're always welcome here, Louise Matsakis. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it. And you know what? You can leave your nose ring on if you want. You don't have to.
I appreciate that.
You don't have to take that out. It's okay. It's okay. If Jack Dorsey can do it, anyone should be able to. Owen Thomas, I think you never had a nose ring. I'm just guessing, but it does look like you have a faux hawk. So I don't know. Is that?
I actually had an earring in this ear.
Earrings okay.
Men probably wear, probably in the Silicon Spin era.
Oh,
so there might be video evidence.
There's video of you, I bet. Yeah. Oh, and it's great to see you. Thank you so much for being here. We always appreciate it. Protocol.com. And my Evan, pleasure. You did great. Evan Brown on the big show, everybody. Ladies and gentlemen, what are you, plug something? What are you up to these days? It's been a long time since we've talked.
Yeah, well, I try to blog when I can at evan.law. Follow me on Twitter. It's down there in the lower third. You know, I have just been really busy working with wonderful clients. You know, about 80% of my clients are technology companies. The other 20% are in all industries, bringing in some kind of technology solution. So it's just a wonderful time for innovation. And I love working with the creative and you know, innovative people that I deal with. So, I'm just out there fighting the good fight, negotiating deals, resolving disputes, doing that kind of
doing lawyer stuff.
Lawyer stuff, yeah. Yes.
Great to
yeah.
see you. It was really fun having you on again. We missed this week in law, of course, and I miss your presence on the show, but we'll get you back here real soon. We appreciate it.
I hope so. Looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you all for joining us, especially thanks to our Twit Club members who help support the efforts here. $7 a month gets you an ad-free version of every one of our shows, plus you get access to the wonderful Discord, the power of the animated GIF, and the Twit Plus feed, which always has something interesting on it. Lisa and I did a special Inside Twit for it. Steve Gibson did an Ask Me Anything. And we've got lots more great ideas coming up. As Joe says in the Discord, join us. Join us. Just go to twit.tv/clubtwit. It's a great way to support our efforts here, and we really appreciate it. We're working. Okay. I don't know what that one has to do with anything, but that's a good animated GIF.
Says a lot, really.
Yeah, for those just listening, for some reason unknown, there's a kid hanging upside down in a swing and running his hair through a mud puddle as he swings back and forth. No one knows why. It's just part of the fun.
It's a really deep metaphor.
There's also another way to get ad-free versions of the shows. We've also turned on subscriptions on Apple's iTunes. As you may know, they have their own. It's audio only. They have their own subscription platform, $2.99. If you just want one show, this show or Security Now, whatever, just one show, you can subscribe to that for $2.99 a month. We do this show, and everybody's invited to watch us do it live. We have a live feed every Sunday afternoon, 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern, 21:30. Oh, no, I have to change that, don't I? Because 20:30 UTC. I think that's right. The math always throws me. Twice a year, I got to figure that all out again. If you want to watch us live, there's a live stream, audio or video, at twit.tv/live. You can chat with us for free, absolutely free, in our chat room, irc.twit.tv. Always great people in there. Of course, there's a great Discord chat going on, too. And it has one thing that the IRC chat does not: animated GIFs. And that makes... And that makes all the difference. After the fact, shows, all of our shows are available, whether you want to go to our website, twit.tv. There's a YouTube channel for every show. You can watch the video there. Of course, the easiest way to get it, subscribe in your favorite podcast player. And if you do, would you do us a favor? Tell the world about Twit. Leave us a 5-star review. Let the world know about the goodness that is This Week in Tech. I think the longest... continuously running tech podcast, or at least one of them. We've been doing this since April 2005. That's a good long time to be doing a show. Thanks for being here. I'm going to say it again for the, 848th time. Another Twit is in the can. Have a great week. We'll see you next week.